department has come back to us to give us feedback on what we agreed on in our last meetings. Now, we are also blessed with the presence of the Deputy Minister, the Honorable Deputy Minister here, which I'm going to start by asking for his remarks before the department takes us through to whatever feedback they are having for the portfolio committee. Honorable Deputy Minister.
Chairperson and honorable members, good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before the committee. As we have been informed per request of the last meeting of the committee to present the costing of the bill that is before the Portfolio Committee on Defense. Chairperson, I thought that it would probably be proper that before the DG on behalf of the department presents the information the Portfolio Committee asked for, that I should provide a context to the information that is going to be shared with the committee. And the context is the following, Chairperson and honorable members, that the bill before the committee as indicated in the bill itself under financial implication for state, it has been the understanding that the costing of the bill will be done after the work streams that we agreed to put together once the bill was passed by cabinet had completed their work. It will only upon the work be upon the work of the work streams that the work streams that the costing of the bill will be provided. Let me indicate that, as you will be aware, that the practice in cabinet is that every memo, it doesn't matter whether it is a bill that goes to cabinet or it's a memo on any decision that cabinet must make, the rule is that the memo that goes to cabinet must also indicate the cost. This bill, when it went to cabinet, the ministry made a request to cabinet that there be a waiver of the rule that the bill must come costed to cabinet for two reasons. The first reason why we ask cabinet to waive the rule to have the bill tabled with its costing was because, firstly, we could not provide the costing of the bill because the population of military veterans that we are talking about, it's a matter that must still be finalized. The number of military veterans that we have on this on our database, on the basis of the CPR list, is not conclusive for a number of reasons. The department has been reliably informed by the task team that came up with this recommendation on policy that the population of military veterans we are talking about does not include people who are bona fide military veterans who, for one reason or another, during the integration period, were not included on the CPR list. And the reasons why they were not included on the CPR list, it was discovered that they are very valid and legitimate. and that those military veterans, as we now are considering providing assistance to military veterans, we should allow for a window period where a process is accommodated to make sure that they are brought within the community of those who benefit from this policy. That was the first reason why we could not cross the field, that we needed to consolidate the database of military veterans, that those who were excluded before should come onto our database. And therefore, the costing of the bill could not be done on the basis of a population that was not the final estimate. The second reason why the bill could not be costed as it was going to cabinet, it is because for the bill to be costed, we needed to get an indication from cabinet as to which of the benefits that we were recommending for consideration is cabinet agreeing to. Which of these benefits that the task team report recommended that the military veterans must get was cabinet going to support. And it is only after cabinet has indicated which benefits it is supporting in principle that military veterans should get that we'll be able to work out the cost of the bill. That is why we said that the procedure we were going to follow was that the work streams would then be established after the bill has gone to cabinet, I mean, has been approved by cabinet in principle as to which benefits was cabinet agreeing to that they will then be able to provide the figures. And of course, the other matter was that cabinet also, as you be aware, in the policy, it also had to indicate whether it agrees in principle whether the support or this benefit should accrue to military veterans and their dependents as a matter of principle. And it is only when cabinet has made that decision as to whether dependents will also be part of the beneficiaries of this policy that we would have been able to then cost the bill. And on that understanding, cabinet allowed that the bill should proceed, that we should proceed with the bill rather, and that on condition or with the understanding that we'll come back to cabinet with the costing of the bill after. When we brought the bill to, when we tabled the bill in cabinet, in the bill it stated then that what I've just said, that this was the understanding that the costing of the bill would be done after. It was not possible that the bill would come costed already for those reasons. You will appreciate from what I said, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that the reason why the bill was not costed, it was for no other reason but to make sure that we provide the costing that is responsible, a costing that is to the best of our ability, a fair and accurate reflection of what this policy is going to cost for government. And there was no other reason why this was not done. What the department is going to present, which honorable members are now having before them, is indicative figures of what the bill costs are going to be. This is not the final costing of the bill. The final costing of the bill will be provided. The final figures will be provided to the committee in time for the committee to make its final decision on the bill after the public hearings that the committee is going to conduct. We are going to make sure that by the time you finish with your public hearings, the final costing of the bill will be with the committee, and this has always been our calculation, that at the critical moment of the committee to the committee with that understanding. Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide that context to this presentation because it was really a matter of concern from our side that it appears that we are now tripping over a matter which we thought was a very, straightforward, issue that we explained right from the beginning. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Deputy Minister. Honorable Minister, you're welcome. I think that was an eye-opener for members, so that they will be empowered to make the informed contributions. I would not open discussions now. What I would do, we'll go straight to the department to make the presentation, and thereafter we'll discuss. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, Minister, Deputy Minister, we are appearing here, as the Deputy Minister has indicated, as the continuation of the process that we had started since the bill was tabled before Parliament. Following the session that we had held, wherein there was a specific request for the costing of the bill, we did accelerate the work that had already started with respect to arriving at a cost estimate, and to emphasize a cost estimate indicative, as the Deputy Minister has indicated. In so doing, we had wide-ranging consultations, and which consultations, I should emphasize, Honorable Chair, which consultations are still continuing. Consultations with National Treasury, with other line function departments. In fact, as we sit here, there is a session that will be going on this afternoon with colleagues from the other departments, as well as the entity that we have engaged to assist us in this costing. Now, in the process of the costing the bill in line with the approved benefits, one of the key guiding factors was that, firstly, the principle that government is providing some of those benefits. They may be uncoordinated. They may also not necessarily having a full catchment of the ministry's essence, which is a specific targeted constituency that we seek to address. So therefore, our engagement and consultations with sister departments was to then say, in each area of beneficiation, what specific benefits or services are being delivered, and then how do we then improve that where it already exists or where it doesn't exist at all, to arrive at some reasonable figure. Of course, Honorable Chair, members, the basis for costing has to rely on what information we have at our disposal. The information that we have at our disposal, as the Deputy Minister has said, is the database of the Ministry of Veterans, which database is still at the same time in the process of being consolidated. Consolidated on the basis that there are those military veterans, bona fide, genuine military veterans, who have not been captured on the database, and we continue to do so, literally on a daily basis. So therefore, the figure that you may be seeing in the document that was handed to you is not a constant figure, but it's a figure that we are working on. Also, cognizant that one of the key principles of the bill is that simply by being a military veteran does not necessarily entitle such a military veteran to one or more or all of the benefits as listed. By so saying, what we are saying is that a means test would be a critical element to determine the extent to which a military veteran is eligible to benefit or not to benefit. So an NDC veteran may benefit with respect to one benefit and maybe not necessarily the other benefits as listed. Chair, in the process of the consultations, we engaged with actuaries who are already contracted by government, primarily by the National Treasury's Government Employee Pension Fund, the Government Employee Pension Administration as well, and have been in ongoing work, I should emphasize, in ongoing work to get to the costing of each of the benefit types that have been listed in the bill under Section 5A. Now, to get into the document itself, once again, which to indicate is indicative, in terms of the benefit type regarding pensions, we made certain assumptions. The assumptions that we made with respect to the benefit relating to pensions are firstly that government is providing pensions to its citizens in general. Secondly, that there are military veterans who may be receiving pensions, but at the same time, there are equally many more military veterans who are not receiving pensions. Now, when we speak of pensions, we are speaking of the different types of pensions which have got their specific criteria for eligibility or qualification. Let's start with the Special Pensions Act. The Special Pensions Act has, as the legislation has indicated, certain criteria that the minimum requirement a beneficiary should have at least spent a minimum period of 5 years either in involvement in the struggle, which then meant that they could not earn a living, or they were in prison, or in banishment, or in exile, but whichever of the two. And even with that, there is a particular process to arrive at then approving that a person qualifies. So with respect to the special pensions, there is a body of military veterans that receive the special pension. But at the same time, equally, as the Parliament will be aware, there's an equally huge number of military veterans who have not benefited from the special pension, primarily because of the eligibility that has been cast in terms of age requirement. So it was also within that context that there were amendments that were effected to the special pension, and then to try and bring in more beneficiaries who are bona fide and eligible to benefit. Honourable Chair, secondly, still with respect to pensions, there is the Military Pensions Act of 1976. The Military Pensions Act of 1976, as amended, also has its own criteria for eligibility. And just in short, the Military Pensions Act is meant for the provisioning of a pension for those members who served in the armed forces, both statutory and non-statutory armed forces, in a period before 1990. But most importantly, who sustained injuries, disabilities, or post-traumatic stress disorder as a direct result of their participation in military activity. This act, as the Honourable Member and Chair will appreciate, was first introduced in 1976 at the height of the so-called Border War, at the same time at the height of the struggle for liberation, but it was then later expanded. Now, with respect to the Military Pensions Act, yet again, some military veterans benefit, and it's literally a handful. Yet more should be eligible to benefit from the provisions of the Military Pensions Act. So even that is another area that we seek and continue to then re-examine as part of legislation that will have an impact on military veterans. The third area of pensions is with respect to the Social Assistance Act, or before I get into that, with respect to the Military Pensions Act, the administration thereof is also with the National Treasury through the Government Employee Pension Fund and the special office that has been established for that. The third area of pensions is with respect to the Social Assistance Act. Now, insofar as military veterans are concerned, it then speaks to those military veterans who fought in the First World War, Second World War, and the Korean War in 1952-53. Now, given that period, it will be appreciated that, as we speak, there are very few military veterans who participated in those wars who are still alive. So they are basically taken off. But that is a very small and negligible number that we speak of, even as we speak to military veterans. Now, having sketched the range of pensions that are available, we should also then not sit back and say, because there are those pensions that are there, that are in law, that are being dispersed, that with respect to military veterans, all is fine. It is not, because much as of all the three that I've mentioned, there are military veterans who are eligible. Again, there's an equally huge number of military veterans who are not eligible for any of those pensions. And that, for us, became what is the basis of costing for the military veterans with respect to pension. And to therefore say that there should be a provision of pension for military veterans in that regard. An assumed number that qualify, we extrapolated from what we have on the database. And that became the best basis of costing and actuarial calculation with our partners, Alexander Ford. So the second area with respect to benefit type relates to healthcare. Healthcare becomes a huge cost driver, given the reality that access to healthcare for military veterans is what has eluded them over the years. And it was within that context that in the process of formulating the bill and also in the policy report of the task team, healthcare was identified as one of the key priorities. Therefore, access to healthcare for military veterans, not only that, but also the other areas as identified in the bill to deal with the disability to military veterans, to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder that military veterans may have sustained. All of that falls under the rubric of healthcare for military veterans. Now, it will be appreciated that out of the totality of what we have on the database, the majority of the military veterans do not have access to healthcare. Access to healthcare, in particular within the military health facilities. Some military veterans, yes, do have access to healthcare within the military health facilities, but some not. It was also within that context that, as part of the process of prioritization of the needs, as the bill says, and the policy recommendation that the Honorable Minister and Honorable Deputy Minister made the policy decision that access to health care for military veterans in military health facilities should be available. As an initial start in two categories. Firstly, those military veterans who are 60 and above, 60 years of age and above, automatically qualify for access to military health in South African military health services facilities. The second category, those who are below 60 but present with chronic illnesses or disease. Also, they have eligibility for that. And as of the time of signing off, we had just about 2,000 military veterans who fell into the categories that have been mentioned. I should say, Honorable Chair, that we continue to receive requests for applications from military veterans for access to health care, also on a daily basis. Now, the key element for delivery of health care to military veterans, and not only health care as a benefit type, but also any other or all of the benefits, is that a beneficiary has to be on the database. Now, even with the delivery of health care, we do check against the database. And as I said at the beginning, given the ongoing nature of the database that we on a daily basis register military veterans, even with the approved policy to begin delivery, we do also receive approaches from military veterans who are not on the database. But we then engage in the process of verification of their bona fide status as a military veteran, primarily using information at hand, secondly using also their organizations to just verify and cross-check with us that indeed this one is a military veteran and this is their background. With others, it's easier, others who may have been in the system, either integrated or received immobilization, or simply just served within the military. Chairperson, the third area with respect to benefit types relates to transport. On transport, the bill proposes that maybe transport, access to transport for military veterans, public transport, either in subsidized form or free. I will not go into the detail of that. And then the fourth area is with respect to housing for military veterans. With respect to that, the Department of Human Settlements, there is some housing that is being delivered to military veterans through the provincial administrations and municipalities. But we are on an ongoing basis engaging with the Department of Human Settlements with respect to ensure that there is delivery of housing to military veterans and a prioritization thereof. Again, the matter of the means test becomes critical with respect to the delivery of housing. Now, before I go into the honoring and memorialization as a fourth benefit type, I'd like to just to quickly go back on the what the cost to the first three to four benefits as indicated, indicative cost of the benefits over a period of 5 years. You will see on the document that you have, if you go to page 9, tells us what the liability is, what the cash flow would be on year 1, what the cash flow would be on year 2, what the cash flow would be on year 3, and what the cash flow would be on year 4 and 5 respectively. Now, with respect to pensions, as you can see there, on year 1, indicatively, is 104, and then on year 2, 106, on year 3, 108, on year 4, 110, and on year 5, 112. On year 2, on the second benefit, with respect to health care, you will see that health care is one of the biggest cost drivers. So the indicative figures that have been illustrated there give you year 1 at 1.3 based on an extrapolation of the data at hand, 1.323, and then on year 2, 1.358. Year 3, 1.394, and year 4, 716, and then 5, 736. With respect to transport, again, an indicative figure, 1.1, and then 73, first year 1, and then 75, year 2, 76, year 3, 78, year 4, and 80 in year 5. Now, to get back to housing, which is where we have stopped, on housing, on year 1, the extrapolation or the indicative figure is at 600, and then also year 2, year 3, and year 4, and year 5 respective 0. Now, let me make a general point with respect to this range of benefits that are before you. Some of the benefits will be once-off. So, which means that a bona fide military veteran who is a beneficiary would receive such a benefit on a once-off basis, and that's it. Other benefits will be on a continuous basis. A typical once-off benefit type, as presented as in the bill, Section 5.1A, would be a matter such as housing. So if a military veteran received a house, that would be a once-off thing. Now, the figures that have been indicated with respect to housing are on the basis of the minimum that the Human Settlements has approved within the context of the approved norms and standards, national norms and standards for the delivery of housing, typically an RDP house. However, military veterans have said in their own words that the provisioning of housing within that norms and standards that has been approved in general does not suffice for the military veterans. And therefore, in 2008, at the housing summit, they actually loudly said that there needs to be a reconsideration of the minimum that is set aside for delivery of a settlement for military veterans. Honorable Chair, with respect to honoring and memorialization goes about honor to military veterans, bestowing the necessary honor to military veterans, honor and dignity to military veterans. But it also goes about ensuring that the memory of military veterans is kept, is not forgotten, for generations to come, for the sacrifices that they have made in the past, in the current period that we are in, and also in the future. So these would go around matters of setting up memorials, setting up headstones for the military veterans, also assistance with burials for military veterans. And again, on some, for instance, on burial, there would be a means test that is applied. And the matter of the means test is something that we should not forget as we come to the application or a delivery of any of the benefits. Of course, with respect to honor and memorialization, that would be the only benefit amongst all of the benefits that would not be subjected to a means test. Moving on the basis that because you are a military veteran, you are a military veteran, irrespective of whatever status or standing in society you may have. At a certain point in time, in the past, currently, and in the future, you will have served your country. So that is not subjected to a means test. Now, the extrapolated indicative figures with respect to that on the first year, as you see on the document, 163, second year, 29, the third year, 31, the fourth year, 33, and the fifth year, 35. It should also be remembered that this applies not only inside South Africa, but also outside of South Africa. Because, Honorable Chair members, you have a huge body of military veterans throughout the world, but mainly and mostly in Southern Africa, who are out in those countries, especially in SADC, but also beyond. And that is an ongoing process also that we will be engaging with as one of the key programs of the Department of Municipal Transit. Honorable Chair, with respect to education, the indicative figures on education, and education should be read to mean both basic education and also a higher education or further education and training. And the indicative figures for year one are the 200, 200, 300, 200, and then 400 and 0 as it tapers off. And then employment, with respect to employment, that is facilitation of employment opportunities for military veterans or their entities or even military veterans' dependents. With respect to that, the cash flow that is projected is at 20, and then that is projected on a once-off basis with respect to that. And the assumption is that once that opportunity has been provided to a military veteran, having applied the means test principle, then that will be on a once-off basis. Similarly with the business opportunities, that is only on a once-off basis to a deserving military veteran having undergone the means test. So, Honorable Chair, with that being the last of the benefit types that have been indicatively costed, the total liability, as you'll see at the bottom, over the five-year period, actually even beyond, but we've projected over the five-year period, totals to that 19.623 as the liability. Of course, as we said at the beginning, we are in ongoing work, even today. We're in ongoing work to continue to refine these figures. And that ongoing engagement with other, particularly line function departments, as well as actuarial costing, will ensure that at some point that figure will come down as we continue to refine our figures and also the basis of costing, also the verification and cross-checking of information at hand, so that in the end we then do not have a situation of double dipping. So, Chair, I'd like to conclude that with respect to the matter of the costing, the rationale for the costing, and also that, as the Deputy Minister said, he indicated that by the time you conclude with the public hearings and the public submissions, we will have gotten to revised figures. Also, more critically, once we have engaged a cabinet on this matter. So these are indicative, as is indicated. Thank you.
Thank you, DG. I think honorable member, we appreciate the department's effort to try to make this costing process as credible as it could be. That should be appreciated. But now I think I should open this to honorable members to make whatever suggestion they have, whatever advice they would have, and also ask questions of clarity. The Honorable Menye, Honorable Governor.
Thank you, Chair. I have a number of questions, but before that, I think I would also just like to be clear that there are large numbers, or we recognize that there are large numbers of military veterans who are in desperate circumstances and who are destitute, and we do recognize that there is a duty to take care of them. But at the same time, as members of Parliament, we have to be sure that we pass a bill that is well thought through, or based on a policy that is well thought through. Chair, is our difficulty, we are in difficulties here because it seems that we have, there's a bill before Parliament, but what has not been settled is in fact government policy on military veterans. And it seems to me that we are almost making it up as we go along. And I'll illustrate that with my question, particularly in respect of healthcare. But if I could put my questions to the Deputy Minister. The first question is in respect of the data. The costing model is based on a sample of roughly 56,000 military veterans. But I wondered if you had estimated the total number of beneficiaries, or the total estimated number of beneficiaries that would be covered by the definition in the bill. Because I'm sure that you would concede that the total number of eligible beneficiaries or potential beneficiaries is much larger than the sample that you've used for the cost. So that's the first question. Then if we come to the CPR itself, I wonder if you could give us a breakdown of the 56,064 military veterans in respect of force. How many members, for example, would have been MK members, UPNA members, or SADF members? I wonder if you could give us some kind of breakdown. I also referred you to your graph on the age profile of military veterans. There seems to be some question, because if you look at the data, and I'm not a mathematician, Alexander Forbes might be able to assist, it would seem that roughly, I think, 22% of the data set are probably about 32 years old, which means in 1994 they would be have been about 15.5 years old or 16 years old. There's a question mark there about the data. How could that possibly be? Then just three quick questions in respect of the benefits. In terms of the costing of the pensions, does that costing include the new non-statutory force pension dispensation, which I believe is costed at around 5 billion rand? That's the first question. In respect of the health benefit, and I think this illustrates the policy difficulty. You have said in respect of health that your policy is to provide health services to military veterans within health facilities. And the two qualifying criteria are an age criteria and a chronic health criteria, and you have roughly 2,000 individuals that are being who are receiving services. But your costing model is different. Your costing is based on the total sample receiving health care at a total cost of or at a net liability of 13 billion. So the question here is, what is government policy? Is government policy to provide healthcare to military veterans within healthcare facilities at a cost at a net liability of 13 billion? Is it to provide a small sample of military veterans with healthcare facilities, with health within military facilities? Or is it, in which case there would be a cost of less than 13 billion? Or is government policy just simply that military veterans will receive access to public health care facilities, in which case the costing is zero? Doesn't seem that we have a clear idea of what government policy is. If you look at what you are saying, government policy is to provide a sample of military veterans with health care within military facilities. If you look at your costing, government policy is to provide health care for all military veterans within healthcare, within military healthcare facilities. So there's a question. Then in terms of your housing, and this is my last question, Chair, in terms of housing, you say that the costing is done on the minimum cost. I thought that the minimum cost for RDP house was 84,000, not 120,000. I wonder if you could clarify that. It seems to be some perhaps incorrect assumption.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I said in the previous meeting, I want to say it again, that in principle, I don't have a problem that the defense looks after its veterans. That is throughout the world, and we know that they are part of a unique dispensation where we have to look after them. But yet, listen, I ask myself the question that you can have quite a lot of goodwill and good ideas and good intentions. But in the end, we must ask ourselves, can we afford it? You know, at present, the members of the Defense Force have a problem with the salaries. The budget of the Defense Force is not adequate enough to ensure that we have a good functional Defense Force and where we can pay our present members a good and decent salary. So there's a shortage of finances. Now, said that, Jefferson, I ask myself the question that if you go through the process when it comes to military veterans, that in the 90s, we had the transformation, we had the different forces, the members of the different forces, the statutory and the non-statutory forces, were given certain choices. They had choices. The choices were they could continue in the defense, or they could decide not to continue. And when they did not continue, there were compensation that was part of the whole process. Now, one critical aspect of this whole bill is the means test. Because, like Mr. Matupi has said, that it is a critical aspect, because the means test is going to determine of how many veterans we're talking about. That is going to have a big influence. Said that, Chairperson, I still don't really understand that we have other pensions, three have been mentioned. It says that the people don't have access to medical facilities. Yes, maybe not military facilities, but I don't understand because, I mean, we have our national health services. If we have citizens who cannot afford certain medical services, they can go to the national health services where they can receive those services. It's the same with certain social grants as far as the children are concerned and everything. So at the present, the government of South Africa has certain institutions to cater for those people who cannot afford things like housing, health, and everything like that. Now we come with a bill and we say that for a specific category of people, we want to give them more. Now, if we have the money, that's a different story. But my question is, if we talk also about 56,000 veterans, why do we come now, after 17 years, with this law? What was the idea? I see the minister is here, maybe she can tell us. Why coming forward with the bill now? Why didn't we cater for the veterans then from the start? That is my question. My second question, Chairperson, is on the means test. Last time, Mr. Matupi said no, it's a general means test that is applied for social services and every other institution. We want that means test. I'm not in the portfolio committee of those committees or departments. I would like to have that means test. Because according to the bill, the means test will actually be determined by the minister. Now, I know the minister quite well, but I cannot accept the bill that gives the minister a blank check that she can determine, because there are different clauses. You can go and look at clause 31C, for instance, and in 25 in the end, where she can give or make regulations as far as the means tests are concerned. That's too vague. We cannot give that powers. So the means test is very important for me. Then, Chairperson, I heard what the Honourable Deputy Minister said about the Cabinet. But my big question is, say for instance we pass this bill. Let's talk about the 19.5 billion rand over a period of 5 years, as you said. Well, let's divide it. We're talking about, say, 3 billion. More, almost 4 billion annually. At the moment, the Defence Force asked for about 4 billion for its budget. It only receives 1 billion. And the argument is, but there's no money. We cannot give more money because there is no money. Now, how and where are we going to get the money for this book? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Masango.
Thank you, Chair. So before I ask questions, Mr. Prada, just one clarity on the same page 9. If you look at the top one, they say pension and this liability as above, the 1.826. Is it the total for the 5 years? I just want to get clarity on that. Is it last time?
I just want to get clarity on that question.
Okay. Captain, why I'm asking this question? Because I'm not sure about what is it all about. I see it, but I don't know. If someone can clarify that one, okay, that works. But when you move to the what do you call it? The employment, I mean business opportunities, there is the 4,000 ones of. And I'm not sure whether a person can start a business with 4,000. Are we really serious to say, is that the money that the person should start a business? And if it is true, I mean, I can also go and start a business with the 4,000 and run that business. It's just, I don't understand it. How can, unless we say you are giving that person. The same applies with the employment. How can a person get a job with 4,000? What is this 4,000 all about? If you can just give credit, I will also be okay on that one. But secondly, we've got this number of 56,064, that we say is the population that we have done for the military veterans. It is also not even a final one. And my worry is, when we will be finished by the time we finish this, if we have to carry on with the deed, how long is going to take the department to ensure that now, by that time, we have the final population. Because by that time, it's not the Deputy Minister saying we will be able to cost. But will we be that time sure that this is the final population of the military veterans so that we can cost it? But the other concern is that after this 56,064, we talk about access to health care. And still today, we are not sure how many people doesn't access health care. Out of the total number. We are not sure how many people from the one who the DTF said, others are from the Second World War, how many of them are there by now? We still don't know, so we say it's a little bit, it's not more of them, but we really need figures to can be sure that how many are there. The same with housing. The DT says some of them are receiving housing. But how many of them are receiving housing out of this? So that when we start with this bill, we really know the figures rather talking about. Some are receiving. Let's go and do and make sure that we get the proper number so that we can be sure how many people are we talking about. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Mackay, can I have the department responding to this kind of question before
Thank you, Comrade Chair. As first question will be because the bill is still going for public participation. What will happen to the costing if during the process there are substantial changes to the numbers that are already in the costing itself? Wouldn't it make sense to have the costing after every other thing is finalized? I was just thinking aloud. I'm saying because the bill is still going to go through the process of public participation. During that process, some clauses might be changed. The figures that we see in here might be changed. What about this process of costing? What is going to happen to it? I just want to clarify that for myself. And another question is it, if we were to be true to ourselves, if this is a moral issue, it's not a money issue, that the person fought for liberation, the liberation of this country, we are not talking money. Some of them have lost a limb, some have died, and they need to get this pension. So if we're going to start talking money here, then we're losing the plot. It doesn't work that way. And we're not going to sit here and start saying that because some people received demobilization fund, that doesn't make them, it doesn't strip them of their veteran status. So if we move around when we talk about veterans, we talk about money, it doesn't make any sense. Because some of the statutory forces have been receiving this. They've always been receiving it. And nobody says anything about that. Why does it become a problem when the national non-statutory forces are to start receiving it? And nobody can tell me that they haven't been receiving that. Because these are just amendments to add on people that have been left out. And if we're going to sit here and start talking money, that doesn't make any sense to me. And a military veteran is just a military veteran. My other question would be in terms of the costing. I see here it says veteran spouse and two children. I've got 12 children. What about the other 10? And what actually informs this? Veteran spouse and two children aged 15. I think I'm still having children even now. I've got a small baby. I just wanted to clarify some of those. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Madhura.
Thank you, Chair. For me, Chair, it's not a question, but it's comment. Firstly, Chair, I will echo the sentiment of the honourable member who has spoken. For me, the operative word is indicative. Now, with all what he has said, the former speaker, honorable member, what we have gone through with demobilization, compensation, can we really put an amount of money to buy lives, to buy injuries, to buy psychosocial problems and all the things that military veterans get during the course of the battle or of the war? Can we really put an amount of money to that? That is what. Number two, I will agree that in this day we are still working on assumptions. Because to do the kind of work that the department is supposed to do, it takes time. The DG has already mentioned that we have a large number of members of military veterans from post, non-statutory force, and other armed forces that are lying somewhere in the southern region and elsewhere. Now, to be able to go back and do that, it takes time. And it is very clear to me that this is not the kind of work that can be done overnight. It is very important that the department take cognizance of all areas that military veterans need assistance on. And then all those areas have already been mentioned. How does a member who can work be able to take care of his or her family once that person was at war or was in war? It is the responsibility of government and the person who was fighting for the liberation or defending the country, regardless of their political affiliation or whether a person was in a just or an unjust war. Because already, when we're coming up with something new, the former military veterans have been benefiting out of government. How is it that interesting that those who are coming from one statutory force, all of a sudden, it's worrying all of us in this house? It is very interesting. Yes, there's not enough budget for the Department of Defense. And also, I'm not suggesting or trying to say, if we do not do this, therefore this will happen. No, I'm not saying that. But also, we must keep in mind that we are talking about people who are militarily trained. And therefore, if we don't take care of them, we don't make sure that they are taken care of and they are dependent. Therefore, you can imagine what will happen. Go next day in Mozambique, go to Angola and all other countries. What has happened? What have you seen? So we should sit here and really consider that when you are coming up with this deal, and by the way, this is not a new deal. This deal has been here since 1999. The act has been here. That talks about military veterans since 1999, it's not a new thing. The fact of the matter is that we're now seeing the urgency of us making sure that we implement what has been on the act since 1999. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Daniels, Honorable Mazia. Daniel Chaperson. Yeah, Chaperson, I'm not sure if we are in order. To me, it appears we are already entering into engagement of the deliberations of the deal before we even have presentations from the public hearings and submissions from the public. I
I ask myself why all of a sudden there is this interest. And I'm not surprised that we get into this engagement, because looking at the statement of the business day, that speaks about this deal. You will understand that our participation is more of a racist participation. Looking at the statement itself, I have not seen anywhere in the bill where the bill is described as an apartheid veterans bill. I have not seen anywhere. But also, Chairperson, I am interested to know how many military veterans are benefiting from the 1976 Act that was amended in 1999, which is now again seeking amendment to accommodate the areas that are now appearing in the bill. I'm also interested to know that what were the benefits if we didn't go through those benefits, and how much budget do we have? Because we are not talking about a new budget. We are talking about an increase to the numbers in terms of the benefits that are already in place, except to say that we now involve different categories in those benefits and in the beneficiaries themselves. Now, interestingly, Chairperson, I would like the department to tell us whether as we speak today, it amounts to this argument we are raising for us to go through with this bill, or whether is it because now, as Honorable Mate has stated, is it because now I am to benefit, and that is why there is a problem today. I want to bring it to the attention of the portfolio committee, Chairperson, that as we speak, we still have people who are out of the country. I personally, my brother is still in Botswana. He's hesitant whether to come back to South Africa or not. Our participation, does it give him the security he wants in his own country? Or are we sending some signals that suggest the reversal of the situation in the country? And I want us to be very sensitive, Chairperson, and be considerate in this deliberations, and would also plead through you, Chairperson, that rather than entering into engagement now, why don't we wait until we have exhausted all processes, and when we get into the deliberations on the bill, all these matters that are raised by the opposition then be brought up, and let us argue them effectively at the right platform. Because I don't think it is the right time for us to enter into the deliberations of the bill, even also of the costing, because these are indicative of the costing. It's not the actual costing as it is expected to be presented.
presented to us. And it is not a new thing altogether. It is something that is in practice. Honorable Miner has benefited from it. He's still benefiting, if I'm not mistaken. And why should I not benefit?
Thank you, Honorable Mazia. Can we...
Tatedias.
I'll come back to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson. And Deputy Minister. I'm not going to deliver it in this field as such, but I want to indicate that the introduction of this bill is not a new thing. One member, honorable member, has just said, it's a very long thing. It's been here for a long time. Now, what I think it has been done is consultation of this bill for our people. I think we are aware that we have been in a very bitter cycle for freedom. We're aware. A number of us were not sleeping. All of us were not sleeping. But now we sleep peacefully. Because of those people who are talking about the military veterans. The statutory force, which were in conflict with the non-statutory in this country, were actually contributing to the budget of the pensions. Non-statutory forces were sleeping in the holes, bushes, everywhere. In prisons, everywhere throughout the world. Some are buried all over the world. Some are still lost. It's necessary for us to look into this, to see how can we assist these people who have brought peace for us in this country. Some of us were still very young. We are reading from the books. We are not reading from the books. We are reading from the practical situations that we went through for many, many years. I think we should appreciate the introduction of the bill. The act has been there for a long time. Honorable, remember that since 1999, it has been there. What is now to be done is a consultation to see how we can assist our people. Chair. Thank you, Honorable Chairman.
Honorable Yari. Honorable Nana.
Thanks, Chairperson. I promise not to be long. First, can I apologize for coming late? It seems that there's a problem of communication between the committee secretary and my Chairperson, secondly, can I commend the department for outstanding work in this regard? To me, it's really long overdue. And also, can I just say that I do not believe that any amount or a price tag can derail or delay this process. I'm saying this, Chairperson, because I am one of those people who grew up in the Eastern Cape. I have first-hand experience of how these former combatants are battling to survive. And for all the years they spent in the trenches, it seems to me that there would be years spent in vain. So I truly appreciate what the department is doing in this regard. But just having said that, what really worries me is the vulnerability of the process. I know of people who all of a sudden are members of a veterans association, and I know for a fact that they were neither in the self-defense units or even in the trenches before. And so what I would really be pleading with the department is to tighten the scrutiny process, because from where I'm sitting, I realize that it's open to abuse. Thank you very much.
Thank you, honorable members. I'll now give the department an opportunity to respond.
Chairperson, honorable members, if I may just come in before the DG and the department officials respond to the question raised in this discussion. Firstly, just to say that I will start first by commenting on the questions and the comments raised by Honorable Member Kunivald, because in my view, they articulated the nub of the challenge that this bill is presenting to lawmakers and to the broader public. And when he said that, when Honorable Kulnaba said that, in his view, this intervention the bill is calling for is necessary, but can we afford it? I want to comment around that question, and maybe later on say a few things on some of the points that were raised by Honorable Member Kunabal, because I think they are a poor articulation of the very same sentiment that Honorable Kunabal has raised. That is the question, but I just feel that you are coming at it in a very less helpful a way of getting us to actually have the right discussion. The issues that you have problems with are very technical and would respond to that. The first point that I wanted to make, Honorable Members, is that the question is, if we say this is necessary, but can we afford it? The question is, what do we make of the problem the bill says the country has and the price we want to pay for the solution prescribed? Do we agree that there is a problem? Or don't we agree? Honorable Kunamba says we agree. But the money we must pay to find a solution to the problem is what he is not sure about. Now, on this matter, I would recommend to the committee members that they kind of go out there and
research done, fortunately, within South Africa by Policy Institute. And one of the policy institutes that has done research work around the challenge of dealing with demobilized soldiers and their reintegration into society. It was done by the Institute for Security Studies. A lot of research papers that have been written around that, coordinated by Yaki Silias, who actually happens to have been or was one of the bright lights within the security community of old towards its end in the 80s. And he argues the point in the research papers that were collated, he argues the point that the challenge or the need for governments to look after demobilized soldiers post-conflict periods is so crucial, and many countries have actually not recognized this to their own peril. And he makes examples of countries where demobilized soldiers' reintegration and welfare was not taken care of, what the consequences were, and makes the point that it is actually a very critical matter to ensure the stability going forward of these countries. The point that you are making, you raise the question, Honorable Kuna, about why we are only bringing up this legislation now. You know, in Zimbabwe, after independence in 1980, they did nothing for military veterans. It only became an issue that had to be legislated for around 1986, 6 years down the line. And as we speak today, the problem of the successful reintegration and the welfare of former combatants in Zimbabwe is among the elements that are contributing to the instability of that country. And this is not my argument, it's the Yakisila's argument to say they ignore this matter at their own peril. As we speak, on the continent, there are 7 countries that are under a program which is coordinated by the World Bank. It is called the Great Nations Integration and Demobilization and Integration Program of the seven Great Lakes Nations. It's under the World Bank, where the World Bank has put in money to assist 7 countries around the Great Lakes Nation to help them deal with the welfare and the reintegration of former soldiers in order to ensure the stability of those countries going forward. There is literature, there is research work done around this. So these are the issues, in my view, that we need to go into and say, what do we think is useful from these experiences to deal with our own problems? That we are only dealing with it now, it doesn't make it less of a problem. Because it only means that there's been an omission which we were not wise to make. We have made this omission all these years, and if we continue in the manner in which we have continued, in neglecting the place and welfare, the plight of former soldiers in this country, we may actually later on, you know, leave to regret it. So, therein lies the question as to whether can we afford it. You know, as any country, we always have many problems. It is a matter which we decide ourselves as to which one of these problems we believe is important, and we therefore must prioritize the resources, the mere resources that we have. It's a political question. If we think it is a problem, then we will actually prioritize
country, housing was not a priority in the manner in which we are spending the resources on it today, post-1994. But it only reflects how the old order government, party government, viewed the challenge of or the need to house the majority of South Africa's population, which happens to be black. It's a political thing. So we've got to make our own. We cannot say, you know, the money is not there. It's in the order of priorities politically, where do we place this problem? Do we really see it as a matter that is critical to the stability and the overall welfare of the country going forward, or we think it is a negligible one? If we think it's a negligible one, then of course we want less money. There's no money. There are more pressing issues ahead. That's how I think we should come at this problem, at this discussion. The point that Honorable Kunabati also raised, and well, I'm just responding to this, but you are raising a very fundamental question, but this is what we need to discuss. And you know, we need to have this discussion. It's not going to assist us, to help us to demonize the bill in the manner in which I have seen mobilization happening outside there, and the media being used for that goal. You know, on Monday, the headlines of the Business Day, first page headlines, said apartheid veterans bill too costly, is not affordable. Apartheid veterans. To the unsuspecting mind of an ordinary member of the public out there, a person would have thought that we are talking about people, veterans, who were tracing the apartheid order, apartheid veterans. But the bill is actually talking about anti-apartheid veterans. Why the Business Day decided to just forget to put that prefix to that anti-apartheid veterans bill and call these veterans apartheid veterans? I mean, it's such an insult. But it's not so much of an insult for me, it makes us not to have the discussion that we need to have. It's confusing the public about what is it really that we have here and that the bill is raising. Non-statutory forces members, as you have said correctly, so were given the chance to continue with their military careers at the point of integration or take packages. It is true, that's what it is. But firstly, what I want us to just remember is that there were non-statutory members who were demobilized not out of choice, not because it was their wish to leave the defense force. They had to demobilize others because of age, others because of health, educational, requirements, that the integration process causes some of the things that were demanded of them that they could not provide, creating frustrations for them. And they were therefore ejected out of the system. There is that category of people who could not do anything. They had to go at the point of demobilization. But there are those who then took packages that they will demobilize. But the question is, what were the packages on which these people were demobilized? And this is what has brought us back to this problem of military veterans. I can give my own example. It depended on the years that the people have been in the Liberation Army. The longer you have been there, then the demobilization peg was bigger. I've been in the Liberation Armies for 14 years at the point of the integration. My demobilization peg was 23,000 rands. Now, I'm lucky because
I became economically active. I could earn a salary and a living wage. But those who did not were demobilized after 14 years with the 23,000 rand. Without anything after that 23,000 rand, it meant nothing. It really meant nothing. 23,000 rand could not sustain them for 6 months. And we are talking about people who don't have houses, people who have dependents with kids who must take kids to school, and 23,000 rand, it's nothing. That is what actually is the problem. So, much as I agree with you, people demobilize on their own, you know, volition, voluntarily, but the demobilization, the problem is that the monies that were issued and were paid as well on telephone. We want to give a group of citizens benefits above everybody else, Honorable Tunabat, as you are saying. Correctly so. Because you added the point that the government has anti-poverty strategy that identifies indigent people and it assists indigent people with housing, RDP houses, they don't pay electricity and so on. So it means that these letters that we are talking about, if they belong to the indigent policies, are there already in government to look after them. But that is not the whole story, in that the needs of these military veterans, and in particular, maybe to a lesser degree, those who are in the statutory forces, those who are in the non-statutory forces, their needs are not adequately covered by the anti-poverty, you know, strategies in government that are targeting the indigenous. And I'll explain this point. You see, non-statutory forces members are people who were not gainfully employed before. They could not do anything for themselves, nor for their families, for their dependents. You can provide them with a house today. Fine. But their health needs are not provided for by the policy in government that that are looking after indigent people in this country. Where we are now, later on, yes, there will be, you know, a cover for that. But secondly, non-statutory forces members, veterans that we are talking about, they are people who have no other skills in life to fall back on. And the reason why they don't have those skills is because for the entirety of their life when they were, you know, bodily able to fend for themselves, they were doing things that were not, it's not possible for them today to continue doing in order for them to live. They've got to be provided with new skills from which they can a living. But the other point also is the fact that because they did not put anything aside for their dependents, their dependents are badly exposed. Now you can say, yes, there are indigent people in South Africa who also have a problem of taking their kids to school and so forth. Yes, they are, but their condition cannot be, their circumstances cannot be equated to those who were in the struggle fighting apartheid, doing work selflessly in the service of the country. If today I do not have means to take my kids to school, and all my entire life I was just an ordinary citizen here, you know, you can't put me in the same boat as a person who was unable to look after his kids. But the reason why he was unable to do so is because he was stuck in the country. You can't put the two of the same in the same boat. That is why they will unavoidably additional benefits that these categories of people must get over and above
why they are disadvantaged was in the good of all of us. It is not out of their own commission. It is because they did things in the interest of other people, not for themselves. The issue about the means test, I think, is very pertinent to say that the means test speaks to police, in a way. But let me make this point, and now this takes me to the questions that were raised by comments made by Honorable Maynir. The task team that provided the interim framework policy, which is the basis on which this bill has been drafted. You remember that when the minister established it in May 2009, after the elections, she said she wants that task team to report by the end of October, within 6 months. Now, the time available to provide detailed policy recommendations was just not there. It was not possible that that task team could drill into details and say, housing, this is the nature of housing that will be provided. This is how much government must spend for the housing of military veterans, because the house must be of this nature, different from an RDP house. Secondly, this is the cohort of military veterans who must be entitled to housing. The others should not, and the rationale why they should not get housing is the following. Those kind of details, the task team could not have time to go into. That is why it was important that the task team must concentrate on high-level policy recommendations. What is it, benefit-wise, that it recommends government must provide to military veterans? The details of which would then be worked out later on, because in 6 months it was not possible for the task team to do all of those details. And this speaks to the poor argument, really, Honorable Maynir, you are advancing that this is not well thought out bill, it is not a credible bill. And if by well thought out bill you mean the bill does not detail policy at the level at which I'm indicating, then you'll appreciate that it's got nothing to do with the bill not being well thought out. The bill is actually well thought out, and I'll indicate why the bill has actually been well thought out. It is because the task team in working out recommendations about what benefits should military veterans in South Africa get, it did not only do research on case studies about what government elsewhere in the developed world and in the developing countries are doing for military veterans, but it also undertook visits to those countries that evinced best practice as far as support for military veterans, looked at what they are doing, how it is solving the problem of military veterans effectively, and on the basis of that exposure of best practice in other countries, came back and said, within the resource limits of South Africa, which of these interventions can be afforded for South African military veterans? Well thought out, not thumbsucking, and no ideas and opinions just arrived at on the basis of desktop information, but desktop information interrogated, interaction with advanced countries that have been best practice, both in developed countries and in the developing countries as well. So the recommendations were well thought out, they were credible. The details is what the work streams are providing. And well, it also takes care of the point that you make, that we are making policy as we are moving along. Now, this is what is involved in the process of generating solutions as far as this bill is concerned. Yeah, this is the process. Work streams are the ones that we indicated that we provide the details. Have we calculated the total number of beneficiaries? It is work in process, as we have indicated. The total number of beneficiaries. I think the beneficiaries take it refers to dependents, isn't it? Yes. The total number of dependents, we're not even there. We're not
total number of beneficiaries, I said there are challenges. I just mentioned one among others to say there are plus, there are the plus minus 500 military veterans who it is known that they are bona fide candidates, but who are not on the CPR list, and we've got to run the process of processing those. But there are also other military veterans who are not part of this database because of political challenges that were there at the point of transiting from the old border after the negotiations when the SANDF was established. And among others, it is the issue of the status of Azanla members, military veterans. As you are aware, Azanla was not part of the troops that were integrated into the SANDF because Azanla did not recognize that integration process because it did not recognize the political settlement arrived at Codeco. So it did not submit itself to integration. So its members were not part of the CPR list. A political decision has to be taken to deal with that matter. So all of these, just giving examples of what are the issues involved in consolidating the database of military veterans population. Those are the issues before you can talk about who, I mean, how many dependents are there. So it's not like people are not we are not working to deal with all of these matters to bring them before Parliament when we have concluded them. Work is afoot to do the consolidation of information around how big this population of the principal members and also of their beneficiaries. The aid structure, on the aid structure is maybe the DG will be able to comment about that. I have not studied the aid structure of this population. And of course, it will have implications on our budget, as you correctly said. Does the cost include the MSF pensions? I think that's what you meant. The MSF pensions are an expenditure that falls within the ambit of the budget of the Department of Defense because it is a part of the salaries, the issue that belongs to the salaries of members of the Department of Defense of the SANDF who are now moving on towards salary. So it's not that budget of the NSF pensions is not part of this costing of the bill that we are referring to here. What is policy on health? Is it for all veterans? Is it only that veterans will access the health facilities that are under the military? No. What the DG was referring to here is an intervention in already done in December last year to get the most needy military veterans health-wise to be immediately attended even before the Department of Military Veterans has received budgets for these benefits. It was agreed that on instructions by the minister that a cohort of military veterans who are of mature age, 60 and above, and those who have health conditions that are very, you know, life-threatening should immediately be allowed to have access to health services within our military health facilities. He's talking about something that is just the immediate intervention towards providing health care. But health care is going to be provided to all military veterans, as the policy indicates there. To all military veterans. But of course, there will always be, as in all benefits, an indication of what is the threshold. If you may need, because you are in the South African Navy, you are a military veteran, and you have a medical aid, and you earn the salary that you are earning, would you be entitled to free health care? That's the, that that's the detail that must be provided with respect to her. But all ministry veterans are entitled to military health. And that health, the health services is not only as provided by the military health facilities, but in military health facilities and in all government health facilities, hospitals and clinics, because if we only say they must go to military health facilities, we have few of these facilities and they are far and wide apart. Military veterans in many other towns won't be able to reach and to access these health facilities. So it does make sense that they must be allowed to be provided with health. The modalities of how that is then paid for within this, the budget of the military veterans is what needs to be worked out. But they must have access to health services of all the other government health center. The housing grant, what is the accurate figure grant now that the Department of Human Settlement is giving to, you know, bona fide recipients of the housing grants under the RDP? The DG maybe would want to assist to clarify that. The other comments made by honourable members are very, very, you know, useful comments. We have noted them. Of course, I will not disagree with any view committee members raise and bring up that that is from what I can, you know, from what I can see, it's assisting us, it's providing solutions, it's reasonable. I cannot disagree with that. Yes. Can I maybe at this point allow the DG to touch on some of the specific matters that were raised as questions by members? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Chairperson, can I, just before the DG speaks, just one remark, and I want to say to the Honourable Deputy Minister that I take up the invitation that we must have a thorough discussion on this issue, because we must get a solution to address a problem that which is affordable. Because I heard the arguments about instability and the Zimbabwe situation and everything like that, Honourable Minister, but I can assure you, if you make promises to these people, and you cannot fulfill those promises, then you're going to get more instability. So it maybe is a very good idea that we have a thorough discussion on this.
Did you? Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, members.
The Deputy Minister has covered, by and large, a great degree of the questions or comments, remarks that the Honourable Members have made. However, I'll zoom into some of them with a view to amplify or some that may not have been covered. With respect to, let me start with the pensions one, because even in the scale of the benefits, that is the one that is at the top. The Deputy Minister has already answered that NSF pensions are not included. And just to amplify that point, the NSF pensions are not included here because those members who are in service now did not receive a demobilization package, which the members who did not integrate received. Leave aside for a moment what the amounts were, and you've already had an indication, as the Deputy Minister indicated. So it would not include that. With respect to the CPR, the Certified Personnel Register, the breakdown of former forces, I'll ask Major General Mashwana to just briefly go into that breakdown of the former forces. And that is the breakdown, at least as at the point of integration in 1994. General Mashwana, through the chair.
The Honourable Chair, Honourable Minister, the Deputy Honourable Deputy Minister. Perhaps before I deal with the breakdown, I think it is important just to add on what has been raised by the DG.
that the NSF is not part of this hosting with regards to the Department of Military Veterans. But however, that compounds the problem of the military veterans for the simple reason that monies have not been made available to pay out in terms of the non-secretary of war, in terms of the former non-secretary of war, who are actually physically outside the system. We then, therefore, form part of the military veterans. They are out, money have not been made available to the military veterans, and their destitution is being accelerated. So, Marshall is not part of this battle. I wanted the honorable members to take cognizance of the fact that there is that category of people who must also be looked after. Because failure of us to be doing that, it will create problems. Just a quick rundown, I can provide an accurate list in terms of this thing. But I know for a fact that in terms of former SADF, and then what is termed the Union of Defense Force, we have got about 31,110. And then about 770 former vendor defense force, about 553 Transkei defense force, 450 Bututazana defense force, and then 15,000 former MK, and then about 6,000 former APA. Now, having said that, in terms of those numbers, if you can put them together, they said 1,110, 770, 540, 450. That is in terms of the statutory process. They are accessing the military institution, including the 9 clinics spread all over the country. That is the statutory process. Now, what we seek to address is to level the playing field so as to be in a position to address the plus minus 20 who are former non-statutory forces and who are not contributing towards the regular force continuing medical fund.
The general is not on the parade ground.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, the honorable member. Sorry, the honorable member. I'm sorry for that, honorable member. It was not that easy. Now, before the honorable Munir, I was saying, because these members, I'll try my best to be because of those members, the statutory forces, and having received salaries over the years, they then contributed towards what is called the regular force medical contribution fund. And as we speak, they are accessing our military fund. The only ones who are not accessing is former non-statutory forces. To be precise, former MK and APA. And are those members who actually opted for a demobilization gratuity. The demobilization gratuity, it was as follows. 1961 to 1975, you get about 33,000. 1976 to 1978, it will be about 28,000. And then, at the last category, it was 12,000. Now, that was 1994, 1995, 1996. With no access to military facilities. That then, what has actually prompted or necessitated us to be here and see. Let's level the playing field and let's ensure that those who are involved in the conflict on either side, that they have been treated the same. This is not a new thing. The bill is there. The bill was there. What we seek to do is to repeal it. That was in terms of those numbers.
I don't know whether I have adequately or sufficiently answered, but we can still provide an accurate figure in terms of that breakdown of the former words.
Then, if we continue, the matter on the housing, with respect to the minimum cost, yes, it is true, the minimum cost is 84,000. However, the figure that you may be seeing, which indicates 120 once off, that is a total including the 84,000. So the difference between the 84,000 to make it up to the 120,000 once off, on the basis of what the military veterans have said, should be added to the minimum that the human settlement is providing. So that figure, the 120, then encapsulates additional to the 84. In terms of the question the Honourable Member Masango has asked, whether the figure of 1.8 is for pensions, yes, that is so. Over that period that is indicated. Now, I should say here, and the question arose indirectly, I can't remember which member, whether is this, all of these figures, is this old money or is it new money? And by that I mean old money would be money that is already available, that is already being dispersed. New money would then be money that has to be added. It is a mixture of old money and new money. And this speaks to what we said at the very beginning, that when one looks at the range of benefits and delivery of those benefits to the military veterans, some military veterans are already receiving within the different programs that government is doing. That would then be what we would say constitute old money. But all of that work is work that is in progress, which we continue to refine as we go along. The question of the employment cost at 4,000 once off, that is the figure that is arrived at with the knowledge and assumption that the sector, that is the Sector Education Training Authority, actually also do have some funding that is available to assist with respect to employment, or even other agencies of government to assist with employment or starting up small, medium, and micro enterprises. So we're looking at that. With respect to out of the total number, how many are now getting housing, we will come back on that. But as indicated, some are receiving. We had figures, but we are consolidating those figures. We had figures from human settlement that made a breakdown per province in terms of specifically how many military veterans have up to this point already received, even as we are going on with the bill and the policy proposal that military veterans should have access to housing. The comment or question that Honourable Member, Chair of the Joint Standing Committee on Defence and Military Veterans, Honourable Member Marquez, has raised more of a comment which we would agree with, but to answer the specific question on the dependence or why limit the spouses, the dependence to spouse plus two, what if the main member has got more? That was worked on the determination of spouse plus two was worked on the basis of an average, because then that where you may find a situation where the main member may have one dependent or two dependent, but others have more. So all of that will then average out with respect to that. But those are things that we continue to refine as well, and will have to determine in specific policy as we expand it. The question that the Honourable Member Daniels has raised, or the comments, remarks, we certainly agree. I think in tabling this bill, there was some, I don't want to call it, members seems not to have been cognizant that this bill is actually a bill that seeks to replace already existing legislation, and that is the Military Veterans Affairs Act of 1999. As it's currently couched, it's quite expansive. It's actually virtually an overhaul. Some provisions in the 1999 Act are still retained. The greater part have been expanded in line with the policy recommendations that were made by the task team. But also recognition that there's other legislation that has impact on military veterans, which at a later stage would need to be looked at, which, by the way, does not necessarily fall within the ambit of the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans or the Department of Military Veterans, but resides elsewhere, the Special Pensions Act, the Military Pensions Act, and so on we go. So that is a process that will have to be undertaken at a later stage. The question or comment the Honourable Member Mazia has made in terms of that we must state whether, I think we'll have to get more clarity on the, on that one, whether this bill amounts to these figures, I think, if I had correctly. We'll need to go back on that. The comment by Honourable Member Diani, we acknowledge that same sentiment that this is not, this is a repeal or meant to repeal the old Act. The comment by Honourable Member Nana that she has raised, that is absolutely valid. We agree that there may be a vulnerability in terms of the process, and that is why we are continuously checking and rechecking the database to ensure that bona fide beneficiaries, bona fide military veterans, actually benefit from the range of these benefits that have been spelled out. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, DG, and honorable members. I think we've come to the end of this meeting, and those who are not aware, I'll allow you to comment if there's any other people to comment.
I was responding to the question raised by the DG.
Then you respond.
Thank you, Chair. In response to the Minister, my question to the Minister is whether he will concede that the process leading up to the submission of this bill was flawed. And I say that because he conceded in his comments that this bill is in fact based on an interim policy framework, and that interim policy framework is contained in the Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans report. Now, my question to the Minister is, that report was submitted to the Minister in November 2009. Why was it not possible, between November 2009 and now, to finalize the policy framework, to develop a white paper, and to properly cost the policy and therefore the bill? It still seems to me that the difficulty we have results from the fact that the Department of Military Veterans has not properly done their homework. That's the first question, Chair. The second question is just a technical question and a question of clarification. In the Military Veterans Task Team report on page 18, there's reference to a recommendation to establish a statutory business vehicle in the Department of Military Veterans, presumably to benefit military veterans. I wonder if you could explain, since, as you claim, this policy has been so well thought out, exactly what you mean, what the purpose of that special business vehicle is. And then just again a technical question, since the national, since the non-statutory force pension dispensation and the proposed revised dispensation is not included in this costing, am I correct there, therefore, that de facto the net liability will increase by 5 billion?
I wanted to comment before the department respond.
I withheld my question, Chairperson. I want to allow Honorable Mendier to play with the field until he is tired.
Chair, we've got a long way to go to achieve that. Thank you.
And thanks for the questions by Honorable Member Meneer. No, Honorable Member Meneer, you're not going to succeed in the line of argument you are pursuing that this bill has been bungled. It should work. You're not going to be able to prove it. And you see what you are now raising. Let me just explain what happened, because I thought that you actually understand why the ministry decided to go the route of the tactic. Or firstly, let me say you are correct to say that the bill is based on the interim report. And what is this interim report? The interim report is an interim policy framework that government is going to use to provide support to military veterans. Interim, in the interim. Why in the interim? Because the matter, once the Department of once the Minister of Military Defense and Military Veterans was assigned the mandate to look after military veterans, it had to do that work immediately, to play that role immediately. However, there was no policy in place about what support this is that we are talking about for military veterans. There was no policy in place. The normal procedure in government is that the ministry will then generate a green paper, have a white paper come into parliament to have a public debate on policy. But that the ministry considered to be too luxurious a route to follow with respect to the agency of the matter, that we needed to provide support to military veterans immediately. That is why the minister decided to set up a task team to provide an interim policy framework. While allowing in the medium term into the future a process where a white paper on military veterans will still be generated. So I don't understand why you actually fail to appreciate that if we had decided to go for the white paper, then we would not have set up a task team. There was no need for a task team. We would have then started right away with the process of generating a green paper and a white paper and so on. But this was for purposes of short-circuiting that process, to say we must have in the interim some policy that the ministry and the department will rely on to provide these services. And we will have the long-term process of engaging the public in formulating future policy on military veterans. So the two could not be done in this matter. You couldn't have a task team at the same time and have a white paper. I mean, then we don't understand why we had a task team. And I thought that this was explained when we came to the portfolio committee to table the report before we explained this thing. The minister received this report end of November, considered the report and took it to cabinet at the early last year, 2010. And cabinet only finalized its decision on the policy in June last year, if you remember the time frame. And we were reporting to the portfolio committee as we were moving along around all of this.
special purpose vehicle. Well, I think we need to give ourselves space to discuss the contents of the bill properly, procedurally, and comprehensively. You know, to go in and out, pick and choose the areas that we want to have to say something around them and pretend like we're having a discussion, I think it's not going to be doing fair justice to the work that we must do. But let me just say, with respect to the special purpose vehicle mentioned there for business support to military veterans, what the policy is envisaging is that the Department of Military Veterans must assist military veterans to be able to take advantage of business opportunities out there. But there are two critical things for empowering any one individual to be able to take advantage of business opportunities. Firstly, is that the person must have entrepreneurial skills, training. But secondly, there must be capital outlay to start that business operation. So we said that it would be too burdensome, the responsibility to say the department will do these two things. It would be proper to establish under the department a vehicle or an outfit that will be responsible for this mandate, providing training, of course, in conjunction with other agencies in government, CULA, whatever, that are providing this training, you know, entrepreneurial training, but also provide military veterans with seed capital. In conjunction with other agencies in government, but that this particular outfit that will establish, it will be said that it has, according to treasury regulations, the ability to raise resources itself that it can then make available or put at the disposal of military veterans. That's what this special was here, because a department would not be able to do so according to treasury regulations.
Thank you.
Net liability, I don't know if the DG wants to speak to that. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
If the honourable member Manil could repeat that specific question with respect to net liability.
I just wanted some clarity. My understanding, and I could be wrong, please tell me if I am, is that the non-statutory force members receive a pension. That dispensation is being revised. In terms of the revision, there would be the cost of that revision would be, or add to the total net liability, I've read, by about 5 billion. I'm not sure if that is correct or incorrect.
Honourable member. I don't think the Department of Military Veterans will be in a position to give that figure. But that figure can be given by the Department of Defense. Because that catalog of people who are referring to have been catered by the Department of Defense, in particular the SNDF. But I know for a fact that they have worked on the figure, but as to how much, I cannot be in a position to say how much.
Thank you.
The Honourable Deputy Minister, I must thank you very much on behalf of this for your committee and the department, because we also have the Minister here. That is a very good indication indeed that the department wants this process to have as much credibility as we can. And I must also thank the member for the intense debate they marked on. It also shows that this is a very serious thing. Everybody is interested in success, I guess. Let's give the department, because the main thing for today was the costing.
has given the department an opportunity to complete work in progress and then to give feedback in terms of you communicating with our secretary, give that in terms of our parliamentary program, and then we'll take it from there. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.